good and some further away. I minimize the risk of imposing monopoly onto my in-group artificially. I'm not neglecting it, but I'm minimizing the risk. So, I score from basically all adult character systems that you could: head, wing, and abdominal morphology, including male and female genitalia. Carry out maximum parsimony analysis in three different programs, basically because I learned by experience that PULP is not necessarily very good at handling difficult data sets. And I analyzed the character distributions in MacLeod, and I then calculated Bremer support, of course, but also partitioned Bremer support. I partitioned my data set in five partitions to see which ones were more informative than others. And I ended up with 65 characters in these five partitions, 15 characters from head morphology, 13 from wing morphology, which was mainly wing venation, 15 from pre-dinitalic abdomen, including the male abdomen 8, Amanda also mentioned, that's highly variable within the physetines, 8 from female genitalia, and 14 from male genitalia. And I've been working on other groups, including butterflies, and this is an extremely low percentage of genitalic characters. But simply, I couldn't score any more confidently. I ended up with 12 most parsimonious trees, 252 steps long, not 251. And this is the consensus tree. And lo and behold, morphology actually tells us something. We actually have all the red dots up here mark actual cactus feeders. This Ragaea here was suggested to be closely related to the cactus feeders. It feeds on Crassulaceae or live forevers, which means that it's pretty easy to suggest to imagine a host switch. And then this gooseberry feeder here, Sophodia, of which it's a bit more hard to imagine how you have a host switch from, in this case, from gooseberries to cactus. And then down here, the phala, which doesn't have a circle because it's predaceous on scale insects, mainly on pine trees. And several actually of Heinrich's groups, what I call the Meskinia group here, comes out monophyletic. The homosoma group comes out monophyletic. And these numbers here are Bremer support values above 1, so it's not a very well-supported tree. But at least it's resolved, which is more than we had earlier for physetines. And I'll just look at one group, the cactus feeders, in broad sense, including Ragaea, Sophodia, and Befala. They appear to form a monophyletic group, and there is actually some character support for that group. First of all, the terminal segment of the maxillary palpus is gramatus, which means that it has a fan-shaped tuft of scales. That occurs in other physetines as well, not in this group I analyzed, but I won't spend more on that character, especially because it's actually reversed in a lower grade within the tree. Then the intercostal of the tergum tree is M-shaped. It's parallel in two of the far outgroup taxa. It basically looks like this. On top you have the M-shaped intercostal, and below it the more commonly ring-shaped and fairly narrow intercostal. The sclerotization of the female dorsum 8 is in dorsal view with an anterior incision. It's reversed in one deep in-group taxa and parallel in one of the far outgroup taxas. And you'll notice that I call it dorsum 8, I don't call it tergum 8, because in Lepidoptera there's a lot of debate about the sclerotizations in the female genitalia, so I use purely descriptive terms. It looks like this. This is basically the anterior ridge of the dorsum 8, and in this case we have a round incision. It can be sharp, it can be way deeper than this, but the margin is never even, as it usually is in pluralis. And finally, what I think is a really good character, this is the male tegumen and oncus and natus down here in lateral view. It's a good example that you need to look at 3D characters, because you can see this character in mounted material, but you have to know what you're looking for, so you have to actually observe it first. But there are sclerotized lobes on top of the base of oncus and the tegumen. And it's parallel in one of the new in-group taxa, and also present in Lotelia. And I don't say parallel because I still believe that there is a good chance that Lotelia actually moves closer to the cactus feeders when we include more characters. But if we look at the different character partitions and their support, if we look at them, there were 33 clades in all in the tree. Head characters supported 7, and didn't support 16. Wing characters supported 19 and didn't support 4. pre-genitalic abdomen supported 17 and didn't support 6, and then female and male genitalia again as head characters were very little supported. And if you look at the total partition Bremer support, we'll see that female genitalia actually have a negative Bremer support. And judging from this alone, you would say that in this case, pre-genitalic abdomen and wing venation are the two big character systems. But if we then analyze the characters, now you can't see this, but this tree over here is excluding genitalic characters, and this one is excluding pre-genitalic characters and wing venation, which were the two most informative character sets. And we will actually see that the one which has the two most informative character sets excluded from the analysis is the most resolved, and the one that bears most similarity to the overall result. And if we analyze the two characters, the two genitalic character systems alone and the wing and pre-genitalic character systems alone, we'll see that, well, there's more resolution in the genitalic tree, but it doesn't bear much similarity to the total analysis, and the other tree isn't very resolved. So the take-home messages here are, first of all, that the general and non-6 97 physical appear to be closely related, but may be paraphyletic. The two other groups here appear to be closely related. The homosomal groups need revision with paleoptic taxa, which I hope to do before I retire. Rostrotelia, we skipped these are more, but these are the two very important take-home messages in the physetine phylogeny. All characters are needed, and we need more characters than we have here, including larval and molecular characters. And a lot of acknowledgement, and that's it.
Thank you.
But the more substantial portion of our results are within the study of Anastrepha obliqua, so I'll use that in the time remaining. Anastrepha is perhaps the most important genus of Tephritids in the New World. There are approximately 200 described species within this genus, 15 that are considered of economic importance, and an additional 28 that occasionally infest cultivated plant species. Anastrepha obliqua, or the West Indian fruit fly, has a wide host range, utilizing resources from about 60 or so plant species. It's a major pest of mango and plums. It also has a wide geographic distribution, stretching from the southern tier states of the United States through Mexico, Central America, and into southern Brazil, northern Argentina. It's also found in the Caribbean islands. Its impact to agriculture is both direct and indirect. It directly affects the value and condition of fruit when the fruit fly larvae feed on the fruit pulp. And both communities and markets are indirectly affected as a result of having to implement costly management strategies like the sterile insect technique, as well as from restrictions to trade as a result when there's an infestation in certain areas and they can't ship out. Previous studies have used Alazyme and RFLP on this and other members of the Fraterculus group. We employ a more informative sequence-based approach targeting cytochrome oxidase 1 and NADH subunit 6. We attempt to show that the genetic variation is substantial and that we can characterize geographic collections. This is all part of a larger study we're performing at Penn State, which looks at pest species from this genus that are of importance, economic importance, to U.S. and international agencies. The results of our analysis is based on our examination of 263 individual fruit flies, which represent approximately 5 to 6 individuals per collection. In total, we have samples, and this analysis represents 46 geographic collections from 14 different countries throughout the geographic range of this fruit fly. Our results yielded us a fragment of 812 bases for CO1 and a 740 base pair fragment for ND6. When we combine these data sets, we observe that there are 72 out of the 1,552 sites were variable. This, in turn, provides us 57 haplotypes for these individuals that we analyzed. Our initial analysis using FST estimates let us know that there is substantial structure throughout the range for these collections. This chart shows the 8 most common haplotypes and frequencies observed for those specimens we analyzed. Now, the most common haplotypes are defined as those being shown by 5 or more individuals. And for your reference, what I've done here is I've placed those 4 major geographic areas with respective sample sizes, as well as the haplotypes and respective frequencies for each of those regions. And before I actually show you the distribution over the geographic range, what I'd like to do is point out some interesting notions about this. For example, haplotype 22 is observed only in samples from Mexico. They happen to be seen in samples from Western Mexico. Haplotypes 5, 7, and 8 are unique only to Caribbean samples. And then haplotype 3 was only observed in samples from Brazil. Now, there were some haplotypes, obviously, that were shared between regions. Those include haplotype 1, which was observed in samples from Mexico, the Central America, and the Caribbean. This is the distribution of those haplotypes over the geographic range. And I'd like to show you some similarities and differences between some of those haplotypes as well as the clusters of haplotypes. For example, this first cluster of haplotypes from Eastern Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean are very similar. These only differ by 1 to 4 out of the 1,552 bases. This next cluster is of haplotypes. And I wasn't able to grab the Panama. You can see the green haplotype there, but it's included, should be included in this. There are 2 haplotypes here that were observed throughout this entire range. Now, we're continuing to collect samples from this area in collaboration with Janicet Silva, but I want you to see that throughout this large geographic range, these 2 haplotypes only differ by 1 base. When we compare these 2 clusters, we see a great disparity. You know, these differ by 30 to 33 bases. Quite a bit of difference. Also interesting here is those Western Mexico samples producing haplotype 22. When you compare that haplotype to this other cluster shown here, we see a great difference as well. 27 to 30 bases. However, when we compare the southern cluster, South America and Panama cluster, to the Western Mexico haplotype, we don't see as great a difference. You know, interesting. These differ only by 15 to 16 bases. And this is just a neighbor joining tree, just kind of telling that same story. We see that top cluster, which has the haplotypes from Eastern Mexico, Central America, very similar to those haplotypes from the Caribbean, which are that group very different from that one haplotype shown by samples from Western Mexico, which are more similar to haplotypes from South America and Panama. All right, so what does this story tell us? Well, what we can say is that the study has provided us a wealth of information that could be used to improve or tailor some of the pest management strategies, such as the sterile insect technique, where differences as great as this could actually translate to biological differences that might be of importance and may suggest that we look at organisms a little closer if we're going to be using them in this fashion. These molecular data may also serve as further tools for, in terms of diagnostics, to be able to distinguish an interception to a geographic area. Certainly a critical component for risk assessment and pathway analyses types of methods being used by agencies such as APHIS, who I work for. Many of these specimens were identified by trained taxonomists. However, we see a great difference between some of these collections. This may suggest that we perhaps revisit the morphology on some of these. Also, in terms of the diversity that we've just seen with respect to the Fraterculus species complex, this may also be of importance when we're looking closer at the species complex and trying to ask more questions of it. So we're certainly very grateful to the two labs that function to work within this project, both the Penn State Laboratory, the McFerrin Lab, as well as the USDA facility in Edinburg, Texas, and of course are very grateful to the funding provided to us by the Center for Plant Health Science and Technology. And with that, thank you very much. We'll be glad to welcome any questions. For the last 3 years, my life has been consumed by noctuids. Particularly, I've been trying to put together a book on about 800 species of eastern noctuids. About 730 of these we've reared or will be figured in the book. This has been a really great project. I've enjoyed it, but doing this and coming across these larvae, every once in a while you come across things that just scream at you as just being wrong in terms of the classification or current classification. And I've worked through about four or five of these, and one of the most interesting ones that came up over the last year that I wasn't supposed to do. Involves this creature. This is Avoglema duomaculata. It's not very large. It's only about 9 millimeters, but it's really an intriguing larva. We beat this off of a lichen-encrusted sort of coastal scrubby area in South Texas. Basically, an area that was very, very rich in lichens and algae. It was unusual, struck me as doing exceptional for a couple reasons. One, it had the longest CD of any of the 800 species that I've ever seen, in fact, any of the noctuids. I don't have any idea why the CD are so long, but some of the CD coming off this animal are more than twice the body length of the animal. It has another really outstanding aspect of it, and it has essentially, I guess, a living cocoon. It takes about 4 or 5 hours to build this cocoon. It meticulously goes up, excises a piece of lichen, and then comes down, and then